Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
Cats with bloated ego. We are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
Extended Clip.
Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 291, and I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
I'm JT White.
And this is a very special occasion. So special that we had to drop the episode a few days late. But you know what? It was worth it. Was it not? Because, you know, something else usually happens on time. We usually do two episodes a week. Last week, there's only one. There was this great filmmaker who every year, like clockwork, would make one movie a year. Released, distributed by United Artists. And then somewhere, something slipped through the cracks. And Woody Allen started being a little less proficient, and his four-picture deal at Amazon Studios to enter the streaming age was canceled, and there was nothing really in the way of going to see your once-a-year Woody Allen movie at your local Lemley in Encino or whatever for the last few years. You know, Rifkin's Festival was 2020, but rejoice now. In 2024, the 2023 film he made in France has finally been released in the United States in very few theaters that hopefully have very dedicated audiences. I would love a scene report from anyone going to the Lemley Town Center in the San Fernando Valley to see it. If just want to know, just want to know what it's like, because I really miss that. That is a nostalgic thought I'm having now. But anyway, Woody Allen's movies are often, some of his movies like Radio Days are about nostalgia. So that's on topic, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, not really, but.
Yeah, no, the seniors are really beating down the door for this one.
Well, when I saw Cafe Society at the no longer existent Arclight Sherman Oaks in the San Fernando Valley, you know, it was a small room. It probably only sat 25 people, and there was like 9 seniors and me. It was awesome.
Yeah.
I had a great time that day.
We just received, you know, breaking news. I just got a picture of the Quad Cinema in New York, and looks like Coup de Chance is selling out. It's selling out theater. I mean, New York makes sense.
Yeah.
That's Woody's home base, you know. But
are you looking at the seating chart for the Quad?
No, it was someone sent it in the chat, just a picture someone sent out.
Nice. You know. Love to see it.
Might need to check the seating chart to confirm, but yeah, it's a... I mean, you know, Woody's got... He's still got fans. I saw that this movie made like $8 million in the box office. To be honest, that's a little bit better than I expected, but
he's
got a better reputation in Europe than he does here, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he went off to Europe for a while. Yeah, I mean, we could kind of backtrack a little. We could do a little recent history Woody Allen in terms of the movies. You know, the other stuff just happens around it. You kind of fill in the blanks. But yeah, I mean, Malcolm, you say that he has a better reputation in France than he does here, or in Europe than he does here. And of course, that goes for a lot of more auteur type filmmakers. But of course, in the 2000s, he did take a little sojourn over to Europe to start making films, still in the English language. But, you know, you got stuff like Match Point and Scoop in the UK, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, you know, Midnight in Paris, To Rome with Love. Then he returns not so triumphantly back to the U.S. eventually. I mean, like, Blue Jasmine was his last film that I would say got general, like, high regard and even got an Academy Award nomination. And since then, the general tastes have moved away from the Woodman's late style, which has gotten even more creaky with age. However, I think there's a case to be made that the films he made after Blue Jasmine are a little more interesting than the more narratively successful, quote-unquote, ones he made just before. I mean, if you're thinking about To Rome with Love or Wonder Wheel, you know, I'd much rather watch Wonder Wheel, even if that one made a lot less money, got a lot less good reviews, and looks a little less competently made. I feel like the recent streak leading up to Coup de Chance just had so many oddities and so many strange things going on. It was a festival of late style headlined by Mort Rifkin.
Exactly. Rifkin's festival is the ultimate. Everyone, if you haven't heard all the buzz and talk about oddities and fascination that you can get by going to Rifkin's festival.
It does seem like I kind of regret this being the only post Wonder Wheel Woody I've seen, because it does seem like a rainy day in New York and Rifkin's festival. I don't know. I just feel like I'd be more interested in them than I am this one, you know, but I don't know. Maybe I'm not as much of a Woody scholar. So I don't know. Maybe if you're like a deep Woody head, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know.
Well, here lies the main problem/contradiction of the movie we're going to talk about, Malcolm. You actually lead into it perfectly. Something like A Rainy Day in New York and something like Rifkin's Festival are both less dramatically successful than this film, I would say. And at the same time, I'd much rather watch those than this film.
Yeah.
What do we go to Woody Allen for? Woody Allen is one of these filmmakers who... certain critics will, as a derogatory statement, say he makes films that are kind of an extension of theater, right? Like the long takes aren't really the immersive, showy long takes you see in film school stuff. It's more of a letting the characters move around and perform these long dialogue scenes. And his films are about these very enriching characters who are, you know, spouting this great dialogue. And in a lot of his movies, especially of these types, like the actual narrative is kind of also telegraphed within like the first act. There's only a couple of options along the way, and the pleasure is hearing these really rich characters in dialogue, you know, played by these great performers. In this one, it just doesn't like have the control of the language. It feels like a remove of someone making a subtitled film, you know. It feels like that all the beats are being hit narratively to make a kind of a very, very light matinee crowd pleaser, but there's something just not there to it, you know, in terms of the narrative. Something just feels a bit removed, and it really does come right down to the language, I think.
No, totally. I mean, this is kind of the first Allen movie I saw where if you told me he didn't direct it, I could kind of believe that. There's still some of, you know, his stuff there, but it just, the story and the dialogue, it's just not very interesting. I was very bored by this movie, and I mean, yeah, with Woody being a dialogue master, you have to just think, you know, things are lost in translation, you know, all the time. And also, it's like Woody's pretty old at this point. And, you know, he's not that good anymore anyways, you know. So, I mean, not to, you know, that's just my opinion. But like, yeah, it's just like he's pretty old and washed. And I don't know. I just didn't feel the effort in this movie. Yeah. And he did just announce that he's like, oh, I don't know about this movie making stuff anymore. You know, he put out one of those statements, you know, when like a sports player is about to retire and they're like, oh, I'm thinking, you know, my heart's not in it anymore. So I could kind of feel that here in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was saying, though, is like it feels like a swing for the fences to get, you know, some last bit of recognition, consciously making a more serious quote unquote movie, even though it's so light, you know?
Yeah. Throughout like the Woodies of the more recent era, you can tell like Storaro is really like taking control in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it's just like that, like, I don't know, there's so many aspects of it. And with these, all of these late Woodies, the fun, the enjoyable part is really like figuring out like the melange and being like, oh, what is this weird mix of something that like sort of feels like a Woody movie? And like this being in French, I think adds to it, where it's just like, what the fuck, like what is going on here? Like there are setups and moments that like recall like previous Woody movies,
of course,
in this like
Match Point, Scoop,
when all of the like the party scenes are very like crimes and misdemeanors, people talking about like other characters. But yeah, no, Storaro has the wheel in a lot of the scenes. And then I don't know, it's just Woody's somewhere in the other room.
And my opinion is Tararo went way too far on this movie.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
It looks like dog shit. I feel like what you're talking about earlier, maybe like some of those early Tararo-Woody collaborations, like they had a crazy look to them. And, you know, it wasn't exactly, I don't know, people levied those critiques to those movies too. And I feel like this is the one that truly deserves it because it just, it looks so bad. I hate the main couple's house with the purple lighting. It looks like a fucking Airbnb. Right? Like, it's just like, I don't know. It's just disgusting lighting.
Yeah, there's a big difference between Coup de Chance and like Wonder Wheel, even where Wonder Wheel, the lighting was, you know, so often just like a heavy color gelled lighting or just colored LEDs or whatever, and in combination with the color grading, and it was very unmotivated, but also just added to the kind of hothouse atmosphere of the kind of attempts at melodrama in that movie. And I don't even think Wonder Wheel is like great. It's just like watchable enough, you know, and this one just doesn't really, I don't know. I think the best summary of it is, I don't know if you guys have seen Hollywood Ending, the movie where Woody Allen directs a movie while blind. that's his character. Yeah. The best line on the look of this movie is Felipe Furtado said he felt like the Chinese director of photography from that movie who's on set with the blind director, you know, or he said Storaro must have felt like that character. And I think that was very apt, but I think that the post-production did even worse because the color grading in this is fucking garish. And I'm not, you know, there are guys on, you know, online on the forums and everything who can break down exactly why color grading and post-production color in general is bad. And I don't know how that works really, but I can just tell when something looks like shit, you know?
Yeah, it's pornography, you know when you see it. And yeah, it does, like, in addition to the lighting, it does seem like the color correcting is, I don't know, like saturating colors a little bit too much, or I don't know the technical terms either, but it's just like, it looks kind of amateurish. Like, it looks kind of like a
low filter.
Rent.
Because there's parts where a character is, you know, in a room with somewhat motivated, you know, color lighting on one side of the room or something, and then they step into light and you just see that their face is just whatever color that they keyed that whole frame to look like. And it's like, that's horrible. That's college
demonic
level amateur shit. And the thing is, though, as I said before, I still stand by the fact that on a narrative level, like on a pure script level, of the old scripts that Woody is dusting off from 60 years ago at this point and doing a couple rewrites on to make them about today's life or in French or whatever, I still do think this is one of the better ones of the last, whatever, decade and a half. But I think that's also really a bad statement about his late career. And if he's a admittedly kind of theatrically influenced filmmaker, which I'll wear as a badge of honor for his peak work, and he always was experimenting with the form in little ways, but you know, you think to like the key moments of his movies, and they're often long scenes between two characters just talking in a long take, you know. It's like the late period stuff just doesn't really have that at all. And it's more about if you're a true sicko and you're going to find pleasure in stuff like Mort Rifkin, or you're going to find pleasure in stuff like Joaquin Phoenix in Irrational Man, you know, reciting some of the philosophical stuff that was going on in, you know, movies from 10 years, 20 years, 30 years earlier that he was writing. And I get a kick out of those things because I like seeing an artist kind of just recycle their own work. I find that fascinating if it's an artist that I'm attached to and find enriching things in their approach to the form. Like I said, Woody Allen, he comes from a kind of theatrical route of directing, in my opinion, but he's also a guy who is obsessed with Ingmar Bergman and is always going to hire a European art house cinematographer. And because of those confluences of style, there's always going to be some interesting results, even in the late period stuff. But this one just doesn't reach any of those points. Like, it has the psychological torture or whatever of other kind of crime films he's done, like Match Point or Crimes and Misdemeanors or whatever, except it doesn't at all. It just sets that angle up, and then there's nothing at all. There's just the one dude kind of brooding for like 2 minutes, you know? So you don't get the psychology of those movies or the philosophy of those movies, even if it's, you know, just passed out in quotes in those movies. And you also don't get the stylistic flourishes that he was letting his, you know, creative team take flights of fancy with when he was working with Sven Nykvist and Gordon Willis and people like that in their primes. And also the writing is just, yeah, it's the narrative is well interlocked, but the dialogue is just, or I would have to imagine it's even more chunky and just like out of place in terms of the present day than like A Rational Man was, because Woody's been hanging out in France for what, like a year before he made that movie? No. You know, like it's kind of weird. And this is the thing that I wanted to like too. That's why I'm like reckoning with it being bad. I had a smile on my face watching this thing. I get joy out of watching Woody Allen make bad movies, you know?
I mean, same. But there's so much of this. And it's not like this quality isn't something that necessarily needs to make a movie bad, but there's no specificity to the region there at all. It is literally just a New York Woody pulled and set into a different place. Like the backstories of the characters just reek of like loose imitations of other Woody characters. I feel like one thing we haven't really, well, I mean, you bring up the theatrical element of Woody's directorial style, like the fact that you have like C-tier French actors doing Woody shtick makes it certainly a lot less fun than, like, I don't know, like Wallace Shawn in Rifkin's Festival doing the Woody. Here it's just like, I don't know, there's no talent, just like across the board. And again, like, obviously I'm not sure how intensely Woody is even directing these performances at this point.
Well, yeah, that was part of the fun, you know, with kind of Woody's directorial work, right? Like you'd see actors step in and, you know, they used to do like a Woody impression. Oh, how is Jason Biggs gonna act like Woody Allen in a movie? We're not as familiar with these French actors. And, you know, with in terms of like the narrative and whatnot, yeah, it feels very similar to a lot of other Woody movies. One ounce of credit I'll give this movie is that, like, you know, it doesn't linger too long. It kind of tries to move fast, but like in Sacrifice of That, it's just like, it feels like everything is dedicated to the narrative in a way. You know what I mean? Like everything is dedicated to like the twist and whatnot, and like kind of, and just, it's just not substantial enough to like, you know, even fill like 96 minutes, you know, for me personally. Every director should, you know, not every director, but every director that you'd like, you'd hope they'd have a career like Woody's. Not in all ways, but like in ways where they, you know, get to make movies year after year after year. And like, we've entered the stage now where, you know, I mean, we've been there for a while where it's like the movies aren't good, right? Like the people enjoying and watching these movies, maybe some of them would say, but I think a lot of people agreed, like, oh, they're not good. These are kind of like auteurist oddities where we get to like examine Woody's choices and we see like, oh, how much of Woody is in this movie.
And there's in the moment pleasure. We're not like, I'm not watching this or fucking Rifkin's Festival stone faced, just like waiting for it to resemble Hannah and her sisters. You know?
Yeah.
But like, I actually gave Wonder Wheel a 3. I thought that one was just like enjoyable and watchable enough because of it having enough of those oddities to it. And same with Rifkin's Festival. It's just such a fucking strange movie, and I laughed so much that I can't not give it a positive score. But even like this, as I said earlier, I enjoy watching Woody Allen make bad movies because there's something very deeply auteurist about that. It's just like, oh, this is an artist I like. I'm gonna examine all of their stuff, no matter what. Like, you know, if I love Bob Dylan, I'm going to listen to his worst albums even. I'm going to listen to, what is it, Down in the Groove? Is that what that one that's called, where he's on stage with the black background? That one's fucking horrible. I hate that album. I've listened to it probably 10 times over the last decade. You know, I'm going to examine it. It's pretty bad. I don't really see myself... I haven't listened to it 10 times. I don't really see myself re-examining Coup de Chance 10 times, but I think maybe in 10 years it will be still a strange auteurist object, especially if it's his last
movie. Yeah, it's probably
movie.
The last Woody, so yeah. That's like that in its own right. I mean, maybe like for the real deep auteurist heads, I think Woody has said he wants to continue writing books and things like that. And maybe you'll get like bullshit like that, real deep odds and ends. But no, it was interesting. And again, I have that same like diseased itch inside of me where it's just like, no, it's not like a entirely like tedious exercise. It is just fun to see Woody make something that is like the most watered down, like shitty version of one of his better movies. But again, this one just, I don't know, lacks the more fun quirks that some of these late period ones have.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, I agree with that. And I don't have like as much of a fondness for Woody as you guys do. So I feel like maybe I'd be more in that mode watching like Rifkin's Festival or like A Rainy Day in New York.
Yeah.
Or like one of the more interesting efforts.
I gotta go back to Rainy Day in New York. I remember thinking that one was bad, but now having watched this, it's like, oh, I can't wait to go back and rewatch Rainy Day in New York. Yeah.
No, exactly. For some, like those movies, I feel like I have, there's entryways for enjoyment for me there. Where like, is this one, I feel like it's the most boring version of all those movies in a way. And, you know, it's Woody's had a long career. You know what I mean? It's like we like what I was kind of getting at before. It's like I'd love if De Palma was in this position, right? Like making a movie every 2 years. And like, you know, I guess we kind of got Domino. I guess that's kind of an approximation of that. But like, it's kind of a fun mode to get into that like not a lot of filmmakers reach in their career, where it's like the fan base is still watching him. They know it's not his best, you know, it's far from his best work, but it's just like people are kind of just examining it. But it's like, I guess all this to say, it's like if you don't have that foundation of auteurist enjoyment, is there, there's not a way in to enjoy this movie, I don't think.
I think if you're an older person, there is. I think if you're an older person, seeing a movie at 11 a.m., there, like this is designed to please an old crowd at a matinee. I think that's why I found I enjoy old people movies too. Like I sit through those shitty old people movies and I say, yeah, this is pleasant enough. You know, like I see why Grandma and Grandpa like that one. You know,
yeah,
and,
do you? The Exotic Marigold Hotel? You watching the Exotic Marigold
Hotel? I'm not watching it, but once in a while, you know, I'll watch a grandma movie and it's like, all right, I see what you did there, you know? Yeah. And this one just has the added bonus for me to sit through it, but I easily can see this killing. I mean, it kind of did in France, so it's like, I could see why the reviews were good, is because that's the aims for it there, you know. Whereas it's not like in the early 80s or whatever. It's not like Woody Allen's aims are for an intellectual audience that has a New Yorker subscription. The aims for this one are like the target audience is a like 70-year-old Parisian woman, you know. Parisian man, maybe. But
you're right.
I love
Woody
Allen. I've never seen his films.
I was more speaking to our audience. You know, I figured there's probably not a lot of
Jerry's
listening. You know, I wish there were. You know, like
grandmas
that go to 11 a.m. matinees. You know, that is an underrated part of cinephilia. They are pretty dedicated.
I talked to this one old lady who rolls out to the matinees at my theater the other day, and she was like, I'm just so grateful for my friend Ruth. She, about 5 years ago, she convinced me to watch horror movies, and just so much has opened up for me. I was like, oh, that's sick. Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was just like describing the concept of The Omen with like such glee. And I was like, yeah, no, I heard about that movie when I was 12, and I also had that reaction. But what I was going to say about this being designed to please old people also is like, so A, you don't get the philosophy of an Irrational Man or Match Point or Crimes and Misdemeanors where you're weighing the actions against consequences kind of thing. And you also don't even see the violent act committed in the beginning. You see the thugs walk into the dude's apartment and then you see his body leave. And I don't know why, I just found that to be such an old person crowd pleasing choice. Just like, we don't need to see the violence, you know. It's very unpleasant. Because Woody Allen movies, when they have a violent crime in them, I feel like usually he shows it. It's not like gruesome or whatever,
no,
but it's usually like cartoonishly awkward, you know?
Yeah, this I was anticipating. I was like, is he maybe going to be alive?
Like, that's what I thought too.
I was like,
no. Leave room for a twist. Ending,
no tricks,
you know?
Up that those sleeves.
I was reminded of Scoop, you know, when Scarlett Johansson, they think she's dead and the main dude thinks she's dead and she comes back, you know, maybe leave a backdoor twist open, but no, our hero of the movie dies halfway through. We haven't talked about what the movie's about. So
the violence real quick though. Woody didn't shoot that because that takes 4 extra hours.
That's the main reason.
Woody's doing 5-hour days at this point. So
yeah, I mean, he's in France, you know, when in Rome. Elaine runs into this lady he used to have a crush on when he was in university, and the opening scene is their chance meeting played in long take, right? And it's the kind of thing where it's not a showy long take like usual, but it is staged as one, so it just kind of feels sloppy and you're waiting for it to end already, kind of like that first scene, that long take. And he finds out, oh, she's married, you know, but I'm still very into her, so I'm gonna keep having these chance encounters with her. And he talks about how much chance plays a part in his life, you know. He buys lottery tickets all the time and he loves the concept of luck and chance. And of course, the title "Coup de Chance" kind of translates to "stroke of luck" in English. So
Woody popped open his Save the Cat for this one. He really believes in luck. One of his traits: buys lottery tickets. What a luck guy.
Luck based lifestyle, you know.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, Fanny, the woman who he was with, her husband says he makes his own luck, you know, so that's a real dichotomy she's got to choose between. He's a very successful man who makes rich people richer as part of his job and also has a model train obsession. And, you know, it's funny. And then you remember the model train in the horrid allegations. The use of a model
Jesus
train.
Christ.
You're like,
oh
wait,
my
why
God,
is
why
that?
Is he doing?
He probably just forgot. He's just like, I like Trent. You know what I mean?
Well, that's if you're using that excuse, then you're really saying he's innocent, because that was the whole thing. It's like that letter comes out, and then Moses Pharaoh writes one, and he's like, hey, we didn't even have a train set. I don't know what you're talking about. And Woody backs that up in one of his books. He's like, yeah, I'm with Moses. We did not have a train set, so I couldn't have molested her, you know? And so that being said, it's very strange to make this character, who is a murderer, have a train set obsession. He's like, God, these murderers, they're obsessed with these train sets, these sick people. Very strange extra textual stuff going on there. And, you know, the irony is not lost on us, of course, that Woody has made plenty of movies about a man who does a bad thing and then may or may not get away with it. And but as we said, there was no train set.
As we say, we defend his innocence.
Hey, all I said is that there was no train set. I said.
That is a thing. People are like, look at all the times where like Woody's kind of admitted that he's guilty in his movies, but actually, I don't believe he's guilty. He's innocent, you know?
Look, man, this is a movies podcast, not a legal procedure podcast, you know?
I didn't bring it up, you know? I don't even know about the train stuff.
You're the one who said the phrase innocent. Anyone who says the phrase innocent or guilty.
True, that does provoke the law. So, yeah. All right, I'll take that.
This is not a legal counsel podcast. This is simply a movie podcast.
Yeah, if you want to break a couple rules with us, we're cool about that. We'll let it slide, you know? Keep a blind eye.
So anyway, Fanny's husband is a real jerk off, and he starts to be suspicious of his wife's affair. And I will say the character of Fanny, played by Lou Delage. The character of Fanny, played by Lou Delage, is, I would say, definitely the closest to a real person in this movie. And, like, I would say for about an hour resembles, this is actually what it would be like, a female character in a Woody Allen movie in a different language, maybe. And then for about 40 minutes, or the other 30 to 40 minutes, she's kind of victim of the whole thing going on here with the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because it's like the Elaine, he isn't even a Woody stand-in particularly. No,
he's just
like,
random.
He's just, a guy who loves random chance. Yeah. And like
so random. But so their relationship starts to sour as he suspects her, and he hires the most plain French detective of all time. Just really underwhelming set, that whole private detective stuff, because the detective that follows them is like the worst detective ever. And I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be a joke or not.
No, I thought that was funny too, because also he kind of has like that male lesbian look to him that also...
No, that... Oh, the detective was a woman, right?
A private investigator? Or am I confusing the characters?
Wait, no. There's a main detective, and then they have someone that follows them.
Yeah, and the person who actually tails the main couple is a woman, I think.
Oh, really? Damn.
Well, maybe that's just what French men look like.
Well, that's what I was, because there was Anatomy of a Fall. There was another character who kind of had a male lesbian vibe that was going viral on the internet for his looks.
Might have just been a lesbian.
Damn. Well, that's my fault. That's my fault, you know. I would blame Anatomy of a Fall.
Maybe that's what she's going for.
Yeah, no. Trying to connect the dots there.
She might take that. She might take that as a compliment. You know what I mean? I don't know. Well, we'll give her our flowers now. You know, we'll give her flowers now because I just to apologize.
Yeah, yeah. Worst detective ever. That lady was very funny. Yeah, I guess. So anyway, Jean, the husband of Fanny, finds out, he calls this goon that he knows for some reason, this Russian goon, and in the most stylized image of the whole movie, he's like in his weirdly overlit apartment and then steps into the shadows and is like a total silhouette with the blue and purple lighting behind him. And it's like, oh, you could make some decent images out of this if you actually tried, but you don't, and you stumble onto maybe two or three decent images in 96 minutes.
There's a lot of, you know, stagey Woody Allen type blocking going on here, but I feel like there's also a lot of kind of like modern, you know, film photography where we have like the cameras kind of follow characters in like scenes where kind of coverage would be more standard, you know what I mean? They kind of go for like a tracking thing. And that stuff is just really bad. And like,
and it's just weird.
And it's just like, you think of like, what Woody Allen movies were good for back, you know, at his best, you know, kind of like this very distinct style of direction. And like the biggest critique I could give, it's just like visually, there's no distinctness. There's no, like, it seems like when I see kind of like this lazy tracking, it's like, is Woody just like telling Storaro, just shoot the scene how you think, you know what I mean? It kind of just feels kind of lazy.
Yeah, I mean, the breaks in the consistent film grammar of his style came within the last like 15, 20 years, and they do all just reflect contemporary trends in cinematography. So yeah, it does seem like an autopilot kind of thing happening.
And it's just very weird because it's like going back to Rifkin's, I feel like Rifkin's is so much more locked down. Like,
I can't remember, laziness.
Yeah, no, that feels like, I mean, lazy too, but like this is sure. just, yeah, yeah, I don't know.
I feel like Rifkin's just has a lot more of just people talking kind of, you know? But they saved all the stylistic flights of fancy for Rifkin's beautiful dreams of classic cinema.
Of course, of course.
You got to save all that style.
The movie sounds so much better than the one Coup de Chance. Like, I feel like I have a chance of genuinely liking Rifkin's Festival.
Yeah, Rifkin's Festival is great. You got fucking Philippe. You got Louis Garrel playing a political filmmaker who talks about his movies are gonna bridge the gap between like the Jews and the Arabs or something.
See, that's the fun stuff where you tell, like, Woody has a contempt for a character he's writing.
Yeah,
what I mean? And you can kind of feel his opinions. Like, it's very hard to get any sense of that here. It does bleed through at occasion, but I don't know. Like, I guess it's like, I haven't seen that movie, but if it's like, I feel like there's an aspect to Rifkin's Festival where you're kind of like, of course you're enjoying it more, but you're kind of just like, oh, Woody's just so old, and you know what I mean? Like, there's whereas that, you don't really have a way in for that here, I guess I would say.
So after he steps into the shadows to call his goons, Alain gets killed, and then he slowly tries to reignite the marriage with Fanny and renews the vows. But then both Fanny and Fanny's mother start to become suspicious. Then the mother, who is very into reading crime novels, plays a little detective herself, which I gotta say, that's like the most hack story beat ever. Like, that is, old person who reads detective novels starts to solve the mystery. Like, I feel like I've seen that 100 times. I don't know why.
And at least 20 of those times in other Woody Allen movies.
See, that's the thing. They all just have a second, third, fourth, fifth fun thing going on in them when it's a movie like that. Like Manhattan Murder Mystery. Pretty standard stuff there in terms of what actually happens. But you have the reunion of Woody and Diane
Keaton. I mean, you have distinct characters. Like, there's nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. You got so many crazy things going on in each of those movies. This one is just, hey, he put together a story that has three acts this time. It's not just Mort Rifkin bumbling around for 80 minutes.
No, he spent...
Which is great.
He spent so much time on the bare bones, just structural outline. Yeah. He's like, I'm spent. I got to get this script done. I got to get this script done in like 5 hours.
Psychology, right? That's like a classic thing we go to Woody for or whatever. It seems like if we were to get that, the movie would have to be set... Or the main character would have to be the husband character, right? Who's like ordering these killings and kind of maybe we get some, you know, moral quandaries with him doing it or something. I don't know. But like with the main character being the wife, it kind of, you know, she doesn't really do anything. I mean, she does cheat, but, you know, doesn't do anything as bad as her husband, obviously, like killing people and stuff like that. And then kind of like in the second half of the movie, she kind of just... The psychology kind of turns off. She kind of just becomes like a side character in her own movie.
She really takes a back seat in that second half.
I love my husband now. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just, I need to get that out of my system. You know, I feel guilty. You know, it's just, so yeah, it's, you don't really spend enough time with any character here to really get insight.
And it feels like a sin to ask for this movie to be longer, but it is, that is how you get... That is how you get those characters that you care more about is more scenes of them doing stuff, you know? But usually that's attached to people like, I don't know, Michael Caine or Alan Alda or
it happens.
Emma Stone was in two of his movies. She's not bad in Irrational Man. She's actually quite good. I thought the To Roam With Love is horrible, though. And her plot line is the second worst part about it. The worst part about it is fucking, what's his name? Roberto Benigni as like a traffic cop. Like, oh, isn't life so random?
I remember lightly liking Irrational Man back when I saw it in like 2018. It's good.
Same.
Something.
Yeah.
So
it's good. It's a lightly likable movie. It's like it could have been done better for sure, but it looks pretty good. Woody caught Joaquin at a good moment, I think, and he's very committed to the role. It's fun.
Well, I mean, also, I guess one other thing about just like the floor falling out lower and lower with each Woody film. It's just like, damn, Irrational Man's a masterpiece. <It's> like,
do like,
that was amazing. Yeah.
It's funny because when I was going through the classics when I was younger, I was like, yeah, Sleeper, you know, it's okay. Love and Death, I don't really like it. But looking back now, it's like, oh, those are like fucking The Shining, 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, yeah. That's just like some of the best shit ever, you know. And Irrational Man's just best of the decade.
This is a good way if you're a director to like get people to appreciate work that they didn't before. It's just to keep releasing worse and worse movies. Like the one from 10 years ago, everyone's like, that was actually, we were too harsh on that one. We didn't know how bad things would get. You know what I mean? We should encourage that behavior.
Now, I don't know what the result of a Midnight in Paris rewatch would be, because that one is... like, from memory, his most contemptible film, just, like, on the surface. It's definitely not his worst-made movie. It's still pretty well-made, and there's some decent performances in it. But, like, I just remember it being stupid as hell.
I liked it in high school, but, like, the very twee romantic sensibility now, I feel like, because I'm not a child anymore, I would sour very much on me.
Yeah.
We're not twee guys. We're kind of, you know... we get our hands dirty.
the mother comes in and helps solve the mystery at the very last second. What a stroke of luck occurs as Jean is about to have her killed when Jean is killed randomly in an accident by some passing by hunters who obviously, put a little twist on what he said about making his own luck. Didn't work out there. And the stroke of luck once again bounced back. The ball from the metaphor in Match Point bounced back to the other side of the net. You could relate it to any one of his movies, but way less impactful. And when they're in the woods, man, those, like, the orange trees are what they, like, keyed the whole color grading to, you know? Like, everything is as orange as the trees. It's so weird.
You're like, is the forest on fire? Are they in trouble? Like, what's going on here?
Is,
like,
this Christian Petzold's a fire?
Yeah. Is this some sort of weird reality where everything looks weird? No. Yeah. One thing I learned, I didn't know French people went hunting. You know what I mean? I didn't know that
I don't think you necessarily learned that.
They're cruel, dude. They eat foie gras. They hunt. They kill their wives. They're crazy. Kill their wives' mothers. I don't know.
True. Anyway. That's why Woody's like, I'm really getting into France lately, you know?
All things considered, coup de chance, I like everything he makes. I am smiling throughout it, often for the wrong reasons. It's a comforting watch for me. It's a definite oddity that I'll think about, you know, time to time, but never in a nostalgic way where I want to go back and watch it. I don't think it didn't have any of those moments that stick out, like in Rifkin's Festival, those funny scenes between Garel and Mort Rifkin himself, or the fantasies, and, you know, or it didn't have like the goofy ass Chalamet Griffin Newman film noir classic scene in A Rainy Day in New York, and didn't have Humpty from Wonder Wheel, you know. It falls short of all those, and all of those are like, yeah, I would say that whole run of movies from Cafe Society onward, even before that, like from everything post Blue Jasmine, alternates between a 2 and a 3. Basically, it's like either 2 stars or 3 stars. This one, it's a 2. It's a light 2. Also,
yeah. It's a very generous 2.
It's worse than A Rainy Day in New York. It's probably, as I said, I think the script is maybe a little tighter than A Rainy Day in New York, but because A Rainy Day in New York has so many fucking stupid things to a general audience that the sickos like us find deeply funny. But yeah, I don't know. I'm going to go 2 bullets because it's hard for me to go lower than that for Monsieur Allen here.
Yeah, I'm also going 2 bullets.
It's the very elder abuse.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's just like... Two gentle, soft bullets to put him out of his misery. taking him out in the woods.
hunting accident.
Yeah, to have a little hunting accident. But yeah, I mean, again, as we said before, there's none of the weird quirk pleasures are here. Only like a very passing fancy There's no Wallace Shawn in Breathless. You're going to be disappointed.
Well, I will say the train set will stick with me. The fact that the killer has a train set, that's just going to stick with me in the larger story of Woody Allen and his films.
That gets a footnote in the writing of, you know.
Yes.
Whatever.
In the next book.
Of the late Woody theory book, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That deserves a little something. I'm going to go 1.5 bullets, you know.
For sure.
Irrational. It's just boring. It's also just boring as fuck. Like, it's just not an interesting movie to watch at all. Like, that's also one thing we didn't really hammer on. It's just like not, there's not really a way in. And it looks, I've lamented enough, but it looks awful. Like, it's a really bad looking movie.
Yeah.
And I guess it's like, if this is a final film, you know, it makes sense. You know, sometimes you like a final film to, like, you know, maybe people who, like, retire a little bit early, like, their final film is like, oh, that's kind of, like, interesting or whatever. He has a good handful of those before this one, obviously. But, yeah, this one's kind of more of, like, the sputtering out final film. Like, he ran out of gas.
Yeah.
You know, it happens to all of us.
It feels like, for the longest time, like, at a certain point, like, the one movie a year thing felt like an obligation, and, like, he had a passing fancy, or just, like, I don't know, he didn't really give a shit anymore, you know? Yeah. You could feel that.
Well, and, I get it, because that's just his job. Like, he forgets about his movies when he makes them, like, after he makes them, and he just moves on to the next one, and that's just his job and his career, and when you're toward the end of a job before you quit, you don't give a shit. You're not cleaning the toilets. You're not restocking the toilet paper in there. You're fucking spitting in the onion rings. You know, you're not begging for tips. You're fucking flipping off the customers.
Is Woody acting like Kevin Smith in the movie Clerks while making this movie?
Yeah, he's on the New York Times crossword app doing the Wordle.
Woody's doing Wordle behind the camera while the French dialogue assistant is directing with Storaro.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, this is, all right, obviously, you know, Woody, it's getting old. You know, we said our piece on that. Can a lot of the critiques we have be applied to Storaro himself too?
He's been criminal. He's been absolutely criminal as of late. I mean, look, Woody Allen made Annie Hall. Storaro shot Apocalypse Now, and he shot The Conformist too, right? Yep. Like,
I mean, he shot a lot of good movies.
He's a legend.
He shot some of the best looking movies of all time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Old Yeller used to be such a good dog. Like, he was probably the best dog there was.
That's what makes it so tragic.
That's why you need two bullets.
You're not sad about killing some shitty dog that, you know, doesn't play fetch. You know what I mean? You're sad because you're killing Old Yeller. He was the man. He was the good boy. But he's equally as guilty for this movie too, is all I'm saying. I'm putting some shame on him.
I do not think this is his worst movie, but it might be. It's close.
Would you say his worst?
I'm looking at my list right now. I would say To Rome with Love is worse than this one.
I have not.
I also really don't like Everything You Want to Know, or Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask.
That one's dog shit.
I really dislike that one. That one is so unfunny. It's insane.
When I was in college, like, you know, just like 4 years, 5 years ago, the chemistry teacher, I think it was, he name dropped that movie on the syllabus and Woody Allen, and, like, obviously was pretty eager to talk about Woody, and of course the young people in my class were horrified at that and were appalled, you know, which I thought it was funny. But yeah, that movie does not seem very good. Doesn't have a lot of appeal to me. Haven't seen it.
I have it tied at number 36 right now with Crisis in Six Scenes. I think those are about on the same level. Although I might bump both of them down because I have Anything Else below them. And honestly, the novelty of Christina Ricci and Jason Biggs being the leads in that one, like, I got to go back to that one. Also, it's Tarantino's favorite Woody Allen movie.
Oh, my God. Crisis in Six Scenes, that's truly the forbidden. I can see him. He says wild shit like that all the time. So I could see,
you know,
Tarantino.
Okay. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, okay. But for me, To Rome with Love is easily Woody Allen's best movie.
was going to say Crisis and Six Scenes, that's the forbidden collaboration, you know, and I mean, that's the
Elaine May.
Yeah, that's my my favorite Woody because Elaine May was involved personally.
That's true. Uh-huh. I think her scenes were a masterpeace and she ghost directed them.
Even each other out there. Yeah,
exactly.
Honestly,
normal now.
Elaine May and Woody Allen together in that was actually funny. That was like the
I bet it's actually good.
That was the last time that he directed good scenes, I think. It also has horrible scenes featuring Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus interest. Stuff is even worse than you can possibly imagine.
That's
like you could tell Woody Allen was like scared to give her notes, maybe. I don't know. She's so intimidating.
These pop stars, they're divas. I can't approach them. It is funny that she's on the list of, you know, the amazing list of actors that Woody's worked with that Miley's on. Yeah. You know, she doesn't even really seem to act anymore. So it was kind of just that, and she was done, it seems like.
I'll tell you what she's acting like. Damn fool.
That's so true. I'm always seeing her in the news lately. She's a big... She's making headlines for a foolish... She's dancing at the VMAs, shaking her ass like a damn fool. I remember when you played
that
country music, lady.
10 years ago. Oh, man.
So I like her song with Mike Will made it. That was a good song.
Okay. So that's going to do it for Coup de Chance on Extended Clip. That was a very fun episode. And you can always subscribe to us on Patreon for $5 a month. You get an extra episode every single week. Oh, by the way, I was placing it within Woody's filmography. In terms of 2024 releases, where would you put this? Because I hate to say it, I haven't given anything higher than a 2.5 this year. This is like number 2. It's Love Lies Bleeding at 2.5 stars, and then this
would be at the bottom of my list. This is not. It's not. I'm trying to think.
Dune, Immaculate. Those are all right below Coup de Chance. You know, on the same level, pretty much. Coup de Chance is better than Dune too. I'll say that with my chest out.
I'm trying. I saw Imaginary, the latest Wadlow, and that movie fucking sucked. Coup de Chance is better than Imaginary, which I'm kind of embarrassed to have even seen. I kind of was hesitant to even mention it on the podcast. But
is that that's not the John Krasinski Ryan Reynolds one?
No, I thought I kind of mixed
those
this up
is
in
the
my
one
head
about
too.
The bear.
It's so fucking
a horror
bad,
movie
man.
About the bear.
I walked out. I walked out. I did
damn,
a walkout.
Walk
I did a walkout.
The walkout.
I couldn't handle it. Time is money.
That's rough. So before we go, I wanted to announce something. We are proud to present the very first edition of Extended Clip Live. And yes, I do mean an actual event that people can go to. New York City, June 21st. Mark it on your calendars. In Greenpoint, I think. In Brooklyn at the Film Noir Cinema. We will be doing a live podcast before a screening of Roger Corman's A Bucket of Blood, a fucking classic movie. And we will be joined by special guests, Nick Newman, Mike Balandak, got a couple others maybe cooking. You know, we're going to keep it a little special guest type thing. Secret special guest to be revealed on stage, because who knows who might be able to swing by in the 500-pound town. But yeah, so New Yorkers, there will be a poster. There will be a link for tickets. All of that very soon, probably by, you know, mid to late April. But so I just was very happy to announce that. And the boys will be joining. It's not just me out there. The boys will be joining me.
Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be an event.
Come out. Say hello. Shake my hand.
Malcolm, have you even ever been to the East Coast?
Yeah. I've been to New York before. But only once, though. Only once. Like when I was in eighth grade. I'm
things have changed a lot since then.
True. I'm a different man now. That's kind of when things started to change, actually, around then. I kind of need to look into that. But I'm a California boy, you know, big West Coast representer, you know what I mean? But I'm excited, man. It's going to be a lot of fun. I feel like we should, you know what I mean? If we all lived in New York, we'd be media superstars by now. You know what I mean?
Oh, probably.
You know, I think that's
if I lived in New York, you know, give me 3 weeks, fucking Ion Packs calling, Metrographs calling, fucking Screen Slates calling. They're all calling. Guess what? I ain't picking up. I'm letting it ring. Because guess what? I'm bigger than that. I'm on Hot 98.7.
I'm chilling with Charlemagne.
Yeah. Funkmaster Flex. I'm dropping Flex bombs.
Yeah, that's not our crowd. You know what I mean? Like, if we could rule Dimes Square with an iron fist if you gave us a month, but we don't even want it. We don't even
want
that, to be
honest. At the jazz club that Woody is still playing at.
Yeah. True. We're trying to go for more of that older Woody Allen-ish type scene in New York.
We will be on the Upper East Side looking for Paul Simon. Looking for the guys from Oh Hello, basically.
You know, we're joking, but I kind of that does sound appealing. I kind of do want to get in with the old money Manhattan, Woody Allen, New York. I don't know.
The thing about old money is it never gets young.
The picture of Jeffrey Epstein and Woody in that big coat, and then we're just slightly out of frame.
Sure, I'm trying to get a picture with Epstein and Diddy. You know what I mean? That's the goal. That's the goal.
Anyway, our next episode will be on Paul Verhoeven's L. That will be on the Patreon. So $5 a month gets you that one, as well as everything else before it, including the episode on A Serious Man. And the next main feed episode, we're going to be joined by Matt Farley and Toronto's own Will Sloan. It's going to be a gangbang interview. It's going to be
we're all going to take turns.
I think Matt Farley would like that.
All I got to say is I'm going first.
You don't say a gang interview.
Yeah, we're trying to be a gang, not a gang bang. All right, you know.
Just a part of that old New York style.
True, that old New York. You fit in well with the old New York.
We will be keeping it PG on that episode, so get it out while you can. What was I just watching that had skinheads? Oh, American History X. Yeah, I mean, that band wasn't exactly like Screwdriver. Like, they weren't playing like white power hardcore. It was pretty straight ahead, like classic rock kind of stuff.
I remember in my screenwriting class, the teacher had like a big American History X poster, and there wasn't much else in the room, you know?
Yeah.
So I always wanted to... You know, it doesn't have a good reputation now, but honestly, the clip you tweeted out made me want to watch it, you know.
It's a very funny movie. I got attacked for saying that it was stupid, because I don't have, like, notifications on for people I don't, like, follow and stuff. So, you know, that post was dead, whatever, a couple hours after I sent it out there, you know, to me. Mm-hmm. And then I look back and see, oh, geez, a couple thousand people, which means a couple dozen quote tweets, which means... half dozen angry messages. Are you a fucking dunce? You think the movie's racist? And I'm like, no, I...
True. You got accused of being woke on this one. People are like, oh, it wasn't woke enough for you, huh? You know, they needed to...
I think it's the opposite. I think it was really the depiction, not endorsement crowd coming for me. They're like, you know, the movie's not about how racist he is. It's about... You know, or something. I don't know. You know, his brother overcoming it and whatever, and him going to jail and not being racist anymore.
That sounds a lot like the Civil War is not about slavery. You know, it's actually about states' rights. That's what it sounds like to me. I haven't seen the movie, but sounds similar to that argument. I don't know.
American History X isn't about racism. It's about basketball. Come on, guys. No, it's a funny movie. It's watchable enough. I've been watching a lot of just like popular studio fare from the late 90s, early 2000s lately. And, you know, even the fucking dumbest movies, you at least want to see them through because there's a baseline watchability. And this one is just very funny. But, you know, maybe we'll talk about it again later.
Didn't you? I mean, not to detract too much, but you also did, like, Requiem for a Dream, yes. Right?
Oh, yeah, that was the night before. I watched that late at night, and then I woke up and slammed American History X. It was sick. Karis over there did mention that they were basically the same type of PSA film. Like,
yeah.
American History X was like Requiem for a Dream, but about racism instead of drugs. And that was a pretty apt perception with like the dramatization of American History X. I was surprised because he didn't learn anything. Like, that's the main takeaway of the movie, is that he literally didn't learn anything. He goes to jail and he's hanging out with the white power guys in jail, of course, right? And then he's
no
mad.
Choice, by the
well,
way. He has
no. He was already a skinhead.
Yeah, he's
that's
racist
the,
beforehand.
That's the chronology of the movie, Bob. Okay. He's already a racist. He's been like one of the big white power gang leaders in LA, right? And he finally gets caught curb stomping a guy and goes to jail. And because he has a giant swastika tattoo, he's got to sit with the swastika guys, you know?
Yeah.
But then he gets really mad because one of them is like doing a side deal with a Mexican guy. He's like, what is this? What are you doing? You know, you can't be doing that. That's really bad, you guys. And they're like, we're in prison. You know, we really don't like your preaching. We're just, you know, regular white power guys, you know, like Ed Norton's on some,
where's
you know,
your principles?
Exactly. Yeah. Ed Norton's like the preachy type of white power guy, I guess. And they were sick of it. So he's like, you know what? I'm on my own. And he learns to understand wrongful incarceration of black people through the coworker that he has to work for, or he has to work with for his entire prison sentence, but like doesn't really, all he learns is that one guy was in jail longer than he should have been, not even wrongfully accused or anything, just like in there longer than he should have been. And then the white power guys gang rape him, and then he's like, I'm done. Like, I can't be racist anymore.
And to be honest, that makes that for a guy who's really racist, that's what it takes to make him not racist. Not like facts, but the rocky reality of life, you know?
Yeah. Rocky reality of life.
It's wild, man. Like, it's such an insanely tasteless movie. There's a reaction shot of like the prison guard like looking the other way and closing the shower doors while they gang rape him, and like cartoonish. He's like, oh, I don't want to see what's going on in there, kind of like you know, it's insane.
You bringing up the cartoonish aspect is kind of why I brought up Requiem for a Dream, because there is especially in the second half, and there was the actor Keith David was like a regular at the restaurant I used to work at out in L.A. Like, he would come in like a few times, but every time I saw him, I could only think of him in that movie and just him saying, I didn't just take it out for air. Like, and it's just like, I was like, that's, I mean, it's funny and he's great. And I mean, like, it's a bad, not a good role, but I was like, I can't mention this to him. I'd be like, that was great. Like,
I mean, I'm sure he gets it all the time. Just like, because if you say you were great in Requiem for a Dream, it's like he's only in what, three scenes, you know?
Yeah. Enact some of the things he does, you know, for him in front of him. Being like, remember that?
So it wasn't the scene where you were with Marlon Wayans. And it wasn't the last time you were on camera either. Marlon Wayans was really good at that too. That era of Scary Movie and Requiem for a Dream, he had a pretty good streak going there. All right, talk to you guys later. Goodbye.